it's the hydrants are flowing on the mountain where the rain falls hard.
Big open house at Augustus Brown Pool. 40 years of aquatic fun in Juneau starts at 11 o'clock on Saturday, February 23rd, with a lap swim and then open swim coming up at 1:30 in the afternoon, and 3:30 again, another open swim. Door prizes, wonderful event to go to and celebrate our 40th year of having a pool in downtown Juneau. And like that, DJ Anton Radke is going to provide the music. My next three guests study a different kind of swimming. I have three of the participants in the Science of Southeast Alaska Sea Otters Symposium, which will be held this weekend, or actually starting Thursday, tomorrow, from 6 to 10 p.m. at the University of Alaska Southeast. Jenny, would you introduce our guests in proper fashion, please? This is Dr. Jenny Eckert, who's of the UAF Fisheries here.
Thanks, Pat. I'd be happy to. With me here, we have Dr. Jim Estes, who is emeritus at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's been studying sea otters for longer than I've been alive. I've been looking up to Jim ever since I was a prospective graduate student. And then Verena Gill is here as well. She's from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage.
Well, folks, welcome to Juneau, and tell me a little bit about what the symposium will consist of.
So I can mention talk about that briefly. I mean, Jim Estes, I'll let him talk about what he's going to talk about. The other speakers that aren't here with us today include Jim Botkin, who is a retired research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he has spent a long time studying sea otters throughout Alaska, and he's done quite a bit of work in southeast Alaska. I'll be one of the speakers, and I'll be talking about the work that I and some folks in my lab have been doing, looking at the impacts of sea otters on some commercially important invertebrate species. I'll let Verena talk about what she's going to talk about. George Essinger is with the U.S. Geological Survey in Anchorage, and he'll be talking about research that they've been doing within Glacier Bay. And then Tim Tinker, who's a research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, he's based in Santa Cruz, same place where Jim Estes is from, and Tim will be looking at some population growth models, trying to give us some insight into what might be happening in the future.
Well, Verena, ladies first, could you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about? You'll need to talk right into that mic.
Sure. Good afternoon, and I will be talking about the current population status of sea otters in southeast Alaska, their distribution, their growth rates, and I'll also be talking about causes of mortality, both natural and human-caused.
And Jim?
Well, my interests have been, for many years, have been on the impacts that otters have on the ecosystem that they live in. And so I'm going to provide an overview of what those impacts are in their various dimensions, primarily focusing on the kelp forest ecosystem, the rock bottom system, as opposed to the soft sandy type systems that others will speak to.
Now, I'm not much of an expert on this, but the little bit that I've read, I guess the sea otters are somehow tied up with sea urchins and kelp in a cycle that has been interrupted by the die-off of the species.
Right. Well, sea otters eat sea urchins, and sea urchins eat kelp. And so otters have a negative effect on sea urchins, and urchins have a negative effect on kelps, and so otters have a positive effect on kelps. And that's called trophic cascade. And so that's the centerpiece, really, of the interactions that I'll be talking about from the work that we do.
And why is kelp important?
Well, kelp's important for the same reason that any plant is important, and that is where energy and materials go from the non-living inorganic world to the organic world. And so kelp is what fixes energy. Kelps are the plants of the coastal oceans, and they basically provide habitat for and nourish all of the organisms that live in the coastal oceans.
My fishermen friends do not appreciate the joy of watching sea otters lie on their backs and stare up at the sky. Are they a real serious predator for commercial fishing?
Absolutely. I think anyone that denies that is basically just not paying attention to reality. They have very strong depleting effects on a lot of the things that they feed on.
And is there any way to ameliorate that? Is that something you'll be discussing at all?
I'm not going to be discussing that. My whole reason to come up here was simply to present what we know about the science of it. And you know, management is a whole other dimension to the problem, and you know, sea otters really have never been managed per se. So how one would go about that is obviously a point of some interest and concern. But I mean, I think hunting and limiting them is probably what the only way that effectively could be used to influence their abundances, if that were the decision that were made.
Well, historically, the population of sea otters was first really predated against by the Russian traders. Is that the dieback that they're still in the process of recovering from, or was there another?
Was the major decline. There were literally hundreds of thousands of otters that were harvested during the Pacific Maritime fur trade. That went from about the mid-1700s to the early 1900s. They were virtually extinct at that point. And what we have now is all outgrowth and recovery from the remnant populations that survived the fur trade. The ones in Southeast Alaska got here through introductions. This was done by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in the late 1960s and early 1970s. In addition to that recovery, or subsequent to that recovery, in southwest Alaska, that is from the Aleutian Islands to about the middle of the Alaska Peninsula, on the south side of the Alaska Peninsula, there have been substantial declines. And by substantial, I mean order of magnitude or greater declines in populations over the last two decades or thereabouts. And we believe that the principal reason for those declines is that they're being depredated by killer whales. So that's going on there. That's not going on here, so far as we know.
Mm-hmm. Farina, are your interests, do they tend toward management at all? Or
We are the management agency. I do work for Fish and Wildlife's the management agency, but I think the symposium really is focusing on the science, mm-hmm. because, of course, you need sound, solid science to make management decisions upon. So, yeah, it's very much based on the science of what we know and what do we need to know to make sound management decisions.
When you bring together this many people from the thing, to what extent do you think any of you will take away something that you don't know from the symposium? Do you learn from one another, I guess, is my question.
Oh, yes, definitely. We you know, we actually have the fortunate it's great that everybody's here for the next 3 days, and we will have lots of time to talk and potentially plan new research projects. So, yes, we're constantly learning from each other. It's very common in the science community.
And I think perhaps the people who come to a symposium like this and hear speakers of your magnitude tend to think that, you know, you're there to present your work. And the underlying reason for this gathering would be so that you can really share amongst yourselves, I think.
Well, we want to share with the public, too. I mean, we could share with ourselves other ways. And the real reason for this is to help educate the people of Southeast Alaska. And we will be streaming the conference as well to other parts of Alaska. So it's not just Southeast Alaska. But, you know, we're interested in sharing this information with the public. And the symposium itself has been organized with that purpose in mind.
So the symposium runs for 4 hours. What's the format? What would I see when I go?
So the beginning of the symposium will consist of talks. Dr. Jim Estes is the keynote speaker, and so he'll have the largest amount of time. But then each of the other speakers will talk for about 20 minutes. And we're going to try to keep that to about half of the symposium. And then following that, we'll have a series of question and answer sessions where we're soliciting comments and questions from people ahead of time and through written comments and questions at the symposium itself. So there'll be time to sort of get feedback on issues that maybe people aren't clear of, or to share information that they might have. And then there'll be some sort of, you know, back and forth about, you know, if there are things that people presented that maybe aren't in agreement, then there'll even be some discussion among the panelists themselves about particular issues.
Jim, what do you want people to take away from your presentation?
I want people to have an understanding of the depth of influences that otters have, the depth and breadth of influences that otters have on coastal ecosystems. I've been working on this all of my professional life, and we have seen a lot of things that these animals do. They are very important players in the system. They have many effects, and I want people to get a flavor for what those effects are. I think it's important that that the public and the people responsible for management decisions have this information as they go forward in making whatever these decisions are.
And Verena, same question. What do you hope people will take away from your part of the presentation?
Well, I hope that people have a real understanding, whatever they think of the Seattle situation currently, that it's a wonderful conservation success story. The otters were completely extirpated from southeast Alaska, and through this reintroduction that Jim talked about by Department of Fish and Game in the late 60s, we now have 25,000 otters, and for good or bad, whatever your point of view, that is a fantastic conservation success story. So I'm hoping people understand that. And then I'm looking forward to talking to people about causes of mortality. That's a real interest of mine. People often see, often wonder, what do animals die of? And so I'd like to talk about that. And then, of course, the hunting, which is unique to Alaska and California, where Jim has done a lot of his work. They don't have that particular aspect in California. No one is allowed to hunt them down here, whereas we have that particular twist up here in Alaska. So people understanding that.
I guess one last question, other than to get the times of the symposium and everything for people to know. If I wanted to see sea otters around Juneau, is there some place that's particularly a good spot to see these little...
Well, sea otters really haven't colonized Juneau.
Okay.
Their population is expanding, and last summer we were getting quite a few reports of individual otters. The whale watching tours see them fairly often. They're out on the water a lot and call those reports in. So there aren't a lot here. The closest place that has a lot of otters is Glacier Bay. So there are 8,000 otters in Glacier Bay alone, and so you can see as many otters as you like if you head over there.
I worked years ago for the Alaska Marine Highway up by in Prince William Sound, and there was one particular glacial opening there that was just, it was amazing. Huge numbers of otters back in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's the kind of habitat that they tend to be largely seen in. I'm curious about a thing you just said. The whale watching boats call in spotting?
Yeah, I mean, I get all kinds of reports in my office. And I spoke last year at a naturalist symposium, which is sort of a way to convey science to the people that are working on the whale watching boats. And so I think because of that connection, people were quite free to say, hey, look, there was an otter here. And so, you know, we're interested in getting those reports.
Amazing. I never would have known that the whale watching boats actually had a scientific or were contributing to scientific knowledge. That's a wonderful thing to know about our whale watching operation, because it is quite huge here in Juneau. There's I think we must take thousands and thousands of people out for whale viewing.
I think there's a chance for a lot more citizen science. I mean, I rely a lot on tourists and whale watching operators to call in carcasses so that I can get fresh carcasses to necropsy. And so, you know, I encourage people that are out on the water, whether you're whale watching tour operator or just someone out for the day, if you see a fresh carcass of any marine mammal, then the best thing to do is to call the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, and they will then farm those particular calls out to the correct people.
Oh, okay.
And then people can conduct necropsies on these animals, and we can learn more. And so there's a lot of that, and I do appreciate when people do pass that information along.
Wonderful. Did you ever use data like that in your studies?
Well, citizen science type
yeah.
data.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of my studies were done out in the Aleutian Islands, and there's no citizens.
No citizen science.
No citizens out there, much less citizen science. So, but we did a lot of walking the beaches looking for carcasses of things over the years. Yeah.
Well, this is a fascinating study or a fascinating symposium. It starts at 6 o'clock. The events are held largely in the Egan Library. Are you in multiple rooms or are you in one place?
We'll be in the big sort of open area on the bottom floor of the Egan Library.
Down there where I think they have a grand piano. So if you,
yes.
So if you want to,
the piano is sometimes there. Yeah,
if you want to intervene with a little music, I guess you could. Anyway, okay, so this is the Science of Southeast Alaska Sea Otters. The symposium is keynoted by James Estes, Emeritus Professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And the other speakers are James L. Bodkin, Ginny Eckert, George Esslinger, Verena Gill, and Tim Tinker. So all of the event is free. and a wonderful opportunity to learn something about one of the key animals in our ecology down here. Thank you so much for alerting us to the event, and I hope we see a huge audience and a lot of people take away a lot of new information about sea otters.
Thanks for having us, Pat.
You bet.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 20th of February, 2013. It's the birthday of the playwright Russell Crowes, born in Findlay, Ohio, in 1893. He wrote the play State of the Union, which became a movie starring Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Also famous for writing the books for musicals. Somebody writes the music, the lyrics, and then all the rest, the dialogue, the words that are not sung, are called the book. Russell Crowes wrote the book for Anything Goes by Cole Porter and the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, The Sound of Music. It's the birthday of a writer named Richard Matheson, born in Allendale, New Jersey, 1926. Stephen King once said, "Without Richard Matheson, I wouldn't be around. He is as much my father as Bessie Smith was Elvis Presley's mother." Richard Matheson was a horror and science fiction writer. He wrote for The Twilight Zone and Star Trek and more than 20 novels, 100 short stories. His most famous books include I Am Legend, The Shrinking Man, later retitled The Incredible Shrinking Man. It was on this day, 1952, Dylan Thomas flew to New York for his first reading tour of the United States to become a huge celebrity, people packing auditoriums to see him and hear his Welsh accent. Stories about his drinking and his womanizing made him a legend. He called himself the drunkenest man in the world. And it was on this day in 2005 that the journalist and writer Hunter S. Thompson died. He shot and killed himself at his home in Woody Creek, Colorado, at the age of 67, the author of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and many other books. Hunter Thompson, who said, "I hate to advocate drugs, alcohol, violence, or insanity to anyone, but they've always worked for me." Here's a poem for today, a poem by George Bilgear, entitled Museum. My father once sold a Chevy to Stan Museum, the story goes, back in the 50s, when the most coveted object in the universe of third grade was a Stan the Man baseball card. No St. Louis honky-tonk or riverfront jazz club could be more musical than those three syllables rising from the tongue of Jack Buck in the dark mouths of garages on our street, where men like my father stood in the shirt-sleeved exile, cigarette in one hand, scotch in the other, radio rising and ebbing with the cards. If Jack Buck were to call my father's drinking that summer, he would have said he was swinging for the bleachers. He was on a torrid pace. In any case, the dealership was failing, the marriage a heap of ash. And knowing my father, I doubt if the story is true. Although I love to imagine that big hayseed smile flashing in the showroom, the salesmen and mechanics looking on from their nosebleed seats at the edge of history as my dark-suited dad handed the keys to the man. And for an instant, each man there knew himself a part of something suddenly immense, as when, in the old myths, a bored god dresses up like one of us and falls through a summer thunderhead to shock us from our daydream drabness with heaven's dazzle and razzmatazz. Museum, a poem by George Bilgear, used by permission of the author here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. back issues, and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 35 minutes about 25 minutes before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We just heard a moment ago about an opportunity coming up Thursday, tomorrow, which is the Science of Southeast Alaska's Sea Otters. This symposium will run from 6 to 10 at the University Library tomorrow. And this Saturday, there's another opportunity to go up to the University of Alaska and to see a wonderful presentation, because I understand that once a month there is a program called Wildlife Wednesday. And so with me is Carrie Howard, a photographer who is going to be featured at that, and Tina Brown, who's the organizer of the event. Hi, Tina. Hi, Carrie.
Hello.
So
good afternoon.
Yeah.
And it's actually tonight.
Oh, is it?
It's a Wildlife Wednesday.
Yeah, I guess that's right. It would be tonight, wouldn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us about Wildlife Wednesday. What is this program?
Wildlife Wednesdays are sponsored by the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, the Southeast Chapter, and we provide people with a wide variety of ways to explore and celebrate wildlife in Alaska, sometimes in Southeast as tonight, and sometimes elsewhere in the state.
And so, Carrie, you're going to bring a lot of photographs and show a lot of pictures?
Yes, I believe that a picture is worth a thousand words. And so, let's see, I think I have, I'll tell you how many words
you're
I have.
You're good for 2 billion words tonight.
Yeah, I've got a lot of photos I'm going to share. And Pat, part of the reason I agreed to do this is we're just so lucky to live in Juneau, and there's so much to see with flora and fauna and scenery. And I'm just the simple girl who'd rather be off in the woods, and I just want to show what's accessible and available for people if they just get out a little bit and look.
So let's talk a little bit about photography of wildlife. What kind of equipment do you use?
I have a variety of equipment. The best camera I have for capturing a lot of the photos I take is my Canon DSLR. But I only have had that for about a year and a half. And prior to that, I had a little digital point-and-shoot, which are really phenomenal, and you can get great things. So people shouldn't be deterred by the fact that they don't have a big DSLR.
Mm-hmm.
They can go out and get photos with just a good camera and patience.
A good camera and patience. And then when you get it back and you look at it and there's a little brown smudge in the center of your screen that you have to tell your friends is the bear, what do you do?
You try again. one of the things that I find about living around here is we're so lucky to be able to get up close to so much wildlife. We were just chatting before we came on the air about bear photos. If you want great bear photos, we all know about going to the visitor center. You just need to keep your eyes and ears open for opportunities and know where to go at what time of year. That's one of the things I hope to do tonight. I'm just going to walk through a calendar year and show photos I've taken each month and say a little bit about where I took them, because I'm more than happy to share the information I know about places
to go. So it's not like berry patches. You're willing to give up the location.
Yes, because they're all public trails or venues that are available to all of us.
Okay.
And we should add that people have enjoyed Carrie Howard's photographs throughout many calendar years in Wild Shots in the Juneau Empire Outdoors section. If you may not know the name Carrie Howard, you still have appreciated her photography all year.
And I think your images tend to show up on posters as well for events that, I don't know, is this one yours?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
not that one.
No,
I'm sorry, I thought you were holding
another. There's another sea otter photo that I think is one of yours.
There's a river otter on front of the Wildlife Wednesday flyer for tonight.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess the other part of this is, do you really have to go out far in order to take good wildlife photos, or are we so abundant with it here that you can do it right in the city limits? Well,
definitely.
Our city limits are 42 miles long. So
most of the photos I take, because I do go out every day of the year with my camera, and some days like this I may only be out for an hour. But this morning, for example, I was out on the wetlands, and my husband and I saw geese, a tundra swan, and mallards and bald eagles, all right there. I think I got a good photo of the tundra swan. I haven't had a chance to download it again yet because the tide was in and I crept up on it. But that's part of it, too. You ask how you avoid getting that little brown smudge. You just learn to be respectful of the wildlife and know which species are skittish, which ones will allow you to approach. I don't ever try to get a photo at the expense of disturbing the wildlife if I can. So it's just a matter of being out and doing it consistently and regularly and always having your camera just in case.
And then if you have several really spectacular photos of wildlife, what can you do with them besides just show them to your friends?
Depends on how far you want to go in the photography world. I consider myself an amateur, and so mostly I share my photos with friends. I do have a number of Facebook friends, and people who are Facebook friends know that I post a photo every day, and so that's always a good way to share. I've just started a community blog spot on the Juneau Empire that I'm going to call Picture Perfect Moments, and I hope to show photographs there. And then, as Tina mentioned, I'm an avid contributor to both the Art in Unusual Places and Wild Shots features that the Empire has, and I submit photos to them, and they seem to like them because they run pretty regularly.
Would you have any objection if someone saw the perfect photo do you want them to give you a credit if they send it to their friends?
You know, I encourage people to share my photos on Facebook. At some point, if I ever do get around to becoming more professional and selling photos, that may become, you know, something I think about. But for now, I just enjoy sharing the beauty.
I know there's a lot of photos on the internet that when you print a copy of them, then suddenly in yellow across the bottom of it is something like
a watermark.
Yeah, a watermark or something.
Yep.
And yours don't do that.
Not at this time.
Oh, okay. Well, wonderful. So Wildlife Wednesday is once a month. What are the upcoming events that we can expect?
We have one more plan for this spring. It's in March 13th, a timely topic. Ryan Scott, our area biologist, and also Tenny Benz from ADF&G are going to present Bear Education in Juneau. Why does it matter? And we all know that it matters. It's important to hear what they have to say and to learn perhaps some reasons why it matters that we might not have thought of before.
Good. Sounds like a wonderful, timely program, because that's about the point where we start flooding our airwaves with reminders to people not to put their garbage out before 6:30 in the morning, because it's against the law to do so. Yeah.
But there are a lot more issues to speak about regarding bears than garbage, and of course, garbage will be addressed, but more things and why it matters.
Well, this is I'm intrigued. So this is Wildlife Wednesday. It starts at what time tonight?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, and it's in the Glacier View Room.
Correct.
If you don't know where the Glacier View Room is, you go up past that wonderful painting of Fish in the Forest, which was put up a couple of years ago on the one end of the building that
Ray
houses
Troll,
the Egan
yep.
Library, Ray Troll's mural, and it's right at the top of the stairs. Up
Perfect,
there.
Right above the lecture hall and just down from the library at UAS.
Right. Yeah, if you go in the library doors, then just turn right and walk down the end of the hall to the Glacier View Room. Well, I hope you have a wonderful crowd and that they enjoy your photos as much as we do in the newspaper when they come out in the wild.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having
Thank
us
you.
On today.
Yeah,
Thank
my,
you.
My pleasure, absolutely.
Just that train.
Gonna catch that train.
One of these old days.
One of these old days.
Gonna catch that train.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
It's about 12 and a half minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon, and my next two guests are a regular Wednesday feature on the program. I'm sitting in today for Andy Klein, and he's the one who normally finds out all of these wonderful things, and then I believe promptly goes skiing immediately after the show is over, or something like that. But from Eagle Crest, Jeffra is here, and Jake, and tell us about the conditions on the slopes, please.
Hey. Thanks for having us this afternoon, Pat. Well, as you can look out the window and see, you can see the snow line is pretty far down the mountain. So we did get about 5 inches of new snow at the Day Lodge last night, and probably pretty similar, 5 to 7 inches, I would guess, up top. Looking at the temperatures, it's about 28 degrees at the top of the mountain. So I'm sure it's snowing at the top of the mountain right now. And temperature outside here when I drove up was right around 38 degrees. So I suspect it's snowing at the Day Lodge because that's usually the cutoff. So we're expecting some pretty good terms for tomorrow.
Should look pretty good overnight. The forecast says that it's going to rain in Juneau this evening, and then we'll have snow late down on the ground here. They're looking for about an inch in Juneau overnight. So you should get a huger dump than that up there. How does that usually compare? How much snow do you get when we have an inch on the ground down here?
You know, it's unfortunately there isn't really a good formula. And this year we have been a little bit warmer than past seasons, so it's hard to tell. But usually if it's 38 degrees or cooler in town, you can bet that we're getting snow.
Mm-hmm.
And it all depends upon how these storms come in. I have seen some times where it's kind of looking like snow down here in town, and it's been that R word up at the mountains. So, but we're optimistic. This forecast looks good for the weekend. We just finished up an amazing weekend with some fabulous conditions, and we're looking forward to continue.
After you get 5 inches of snow, then what do you have to do to prepare the place? Is there anything that's done? After a big snowfall?
Well, we have a team of groomers that work every night. So while you and I are sleeping, these guys are out on the mountain, and what they do is they actually groom this new snow to perfection on some of the beginner and intermediate runs. And that just helps pack down that snow. That helps keep that snow there, so it helps build what we call a base. And so those guys are working every night. Then, obviously, the next day, there's always people when we have fresh snow. They're out looking for some turns. And so the skiers and riders go off the groomed terrain and ski and ride on those that terrain, and that also serves to pack it down and preserve it. So it's just a very cyclic action that happens every day.
I guess I'm wondering about grooming. How is that done? Do you have equipment or is it
we
people?
We do. We have a fleet of 4 or 5 snow cats, 4 cats that actually work on the mountain regularly, and they just go out. It's a kind of a big tractor. Pat's got tracks on it, packs the snow down. It's got a blade on it, and it can move snow around, and then it's got a tiller on it that just puts an amazing surface on that snow. So it's really fun to go out and ski some of that groomed stuff.
So now, if you want to ski the freshly groomed trail from overnight, you have to be right up there at the start of the day. How much does it wear in during the course of a day?
Oh, it doesn't necessarily wear in, but it'll get it skied off. It's what we call corduroy, and the reason it's called corduroy is because the tracks leave just kind of a corduroy impression into the snow, and it can be a very kind of a little bit firm surface depending upon the snow, but very smooth, even turning. And so as the day wears on, the snow gets pushed up in places and turns, and you can end up with some small bumps or moguls, as we call them. And it's just not quite as smooth, but it's still every bit as fun.
Yeah. Jake, what's your role at Eagle Crest?
I'm doing marketing along with Jeffrey here. So we have some fun news today, actually, which is to let folks know that on Thursday we're extending our hours a little bit on the Ptarmigan chairlift. So all of our chairs will now be open until 4 p.m. So that means on Thursday through Mondays, our Porcupine chair, which is our beginner chair, our Hooter, which is kind of our intermediate chair, and our Ptarmigan chairlift will be open from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mm. And then on the weekends, the Black Bear chairlift will be open from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m.
That's kind of our a sign of spring, these long days, so our hours get extended, more daylight, so it's great. We enjoy this time of year.
We have a time change coming up. What's that going to do to your plans?
It doesn't do anything to us. It just makes us, you know, obviously all of us will have more daylight, but we keep our hours at 9 to 4. This is the longest our day is right now.
How much longer do you expect that there will be good skiing conditions?
Oh, I think that we're going to have good skiing right through our closing date, which is April 14th. Mm-hmm. So we still have quite a long season. And just a reminder that we are open daily for spring break, and I believe that starts the 14th of March, every day through, I believe it's the 27th of March. So we're open daily through for spring break. Our snow bus runs every day during spring break. So now's the time people are starting to think about spring, think about what they're going to do when the kids are out of school. But we're going to be open, and we have fabulous conditions.
How about that snow bus schedule? How does that work?
You can find that online, but it's typically running on the weekends and holidays. And any time that the schools are closed, you can usually bank on the fact that the snow bus will be running. And, again, you can find that at skijuno.com.
Okay. How often does it run normally?
It runs once a day, so it will run up the mountain, and everyone will arrive there at 9 a.m. in time for the first chairlift to open up, and then it will leave the mountain, leave Eagle Crest at 4 p.m.
Ah, so it's planning the day.
It is, yeah.
Yep. Up on the slopes. Mm-hmm. And there's a full equipment rental shop up there as well, right? So you really don't have to have anything to go skiing at Eagle Crest.
No, we rent snowboards and boots. We rent skis, ski boots, and poles. So we have all sizes for kids and adults. We also have Nordic Classic gear for rent as well. So if you aren't looking to downhill ski or snowboard but want to try out our cross-country trails, you can rent Classic gear as well.
A friend told me a wonderful story. He said that he had come down here to interview for a job years ago, and it was raining in Juneau. It was, I think it might have been about February or something like that, and it was really sloppy around here in Gray. And his friend said to him, "So, you want to go skiing?" And he said, "What do you mean?" He didn't know that Eagle Crest was there. And he said they went up on the slopes, and it was absolutely gorgeous up there. Sun was out, and it was above the clouds, and they skied all day. And the guy said, "I'm sold. I'll take the jobs."
Anyway. Often the case, I feel that, you know, I head out of here in the morning, and it's raining, and it looks really dreary at certain days, and head up the mountain, and all of a sudden I see the sun. It's a pretty incredible thing.
Yeah, and there it is. It was there all along, I guess. Okay, so is there anything else that people who are thinking about spending some time out at Eagle Crest need to know?
Well, I think you can find information at skijuna.com and just kind of give a little teaser. We have a huge event coming up.
March 10th, we have the High Gravity Games. This will be our third annual High Gravity Games, which is a partnership with Alaskan Brewing Company and Eagle Crest. We have a few other sponsors helping out as well, but we have three big events that day, which are the Startup Cup, the Keg Toss, and the Crash Cool Dummy. So check it out at skijuno.com. We have registration forms, all the info there right now. So start gathering up a team of your favorite allies in town, because it's a good competition to compete in no matter your skill level.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on Eagle Crest, a really important part of living here in Juneau.
Great. Thanks for having
us, Pat.
Lots of opportunities for midweek interest. Let's see. The Augustus Brown Pool is turning 40, so the birthday party is on Saturday. Reserve yourself a little time for that, because swimming is free. Let's see. Tomorrow night, the Sea Otter Symposium out at the UAS Egan Library will be from 6 until 10 p.m. It's Wildlife Wednesday tonight with Carrie Howard's photographs. You've seen them in the daily paper, and they are going to be on display with a lot of her reminiscences of how she took them at Wildlife Wednesday at the University of Alaska Southeast tonight. And Eagle Crest is open, and the snow is good, and it's roaring up there, so good times up on the slopes. Matt Miller will be your host tomorrow on Juneau Afternoon. The Empty Chair Memorial Project concert is coming up, and he'll be interviewing some of the folks who will be in there. He'll also talk with some folks from NAMI to talk about a family-to-family support group. And former Senator Vic Fisher is in town. He'll be talking about his new book, To Russia with Love, and our regular feature with Nancy DeCherney, Arts Up. We'll finish out tomorrow afternoon's show. So tune in to Juno Afternoon tomorrow afternoon. We are KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We are also heard throughout the area on a set of translators. The translators are K276AF. It serves the valley in Auk Bay on 103.1 MHz. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, you get a slightly better signal on K269AO if you tune your radio to 101.7. Gustavus listens to KTO 1 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, the signal is on 89.9 MHz from K210AS. In Juneau, you can hear us on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. On 872 is KRNN, and KXLL is on 873. And we are also online at www.ktoo.org. Pat Moore, been your host today for Juneau Afternoon. I've really enjoyed bringing you some events around Juneau and talking to these wonderful people who are putting them together. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.